Now, our panel today, Gareth Sheehan, is a former judge of the Court of Appeal. Jean Kelly is a partner and a solicitor in technology law with LK Shields. Niamh Horrigan is the Vice President of Mary Immaculate College Limerick. Dara Doyle is the Bloomberg Bureau Chief in Dublin. And Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and an Irish Examiner columnist. And obviously, all the papers are full of poor Anna Creagell, and they're also full of a lot of the discussions and stories that have come out from the case as the week has gone on. And look, we're conscious that this is still a live case, sentencing is to come, so I think we'll be judicious about how we discuss these issues, but I do think we should discuss some of the issues, but we will be careful around it. But I suppose one thing that really has become clear in the last few days, I think a lot of people probably made a decision early on in this case that they weren't interested in reading about it. I know a lot of people who just thought this is too upsetting, but I think that people have really become very engaged with this, and people have all had their own kind of various personal reactions to it. It really has kind of shocked people, I think. Niamh Horrigan, what was your personal reaction to it?
Well, I was one of those people who avoided it really quite extensively on all media forums. And I think my reasons for avoiding it were twofold. First was that I have children in around that age myself. I have a boy and a girl. And obviously it comes very close to the bone when you're, you know, trying to rear children day to day who are kind of in that space and trying to operate in that space. The second thing, I suppose, is that for me, I think obviously all of us, even if you're grown up and have kids yourself, you've also been that age. You've been a kind of early teenager. And it's such a difficult age to be. And it really brought back memories for me of how difficult it was to be that age and the kinds of things people do and the things that people say and the way kids of that stage are so fragile. And so like that, Brendan, for a long time, I just couldn't deal with it or engage with it. I suppose this week, you know, in the aftermath of what everything has done, and I think some people, even like myself, who are very much avoiding it, have come to it maybe closer a bit more in terms of the lessons that can be learned. And I suppose for me, I have a particular interest because obviously because I work at Mary Immaculate College and we have a lot of engagement with schools. And so we're very conscious of all the protections that exist around children now in terms of how you educate teachers, in terms of child safeguarding, do you know what I mean? And yet at the same time, you know, you have something like this emerge in the context of all of that. And I mean, my own background as a sociologist, the work I've done in the area of child protection for years, and like there's been a transformation in that space really in the last 20 years in particular. Mm-hmm. And after all that work, to see a case like this emerge is kind of upsetting, I think, at a very foundational level. And I know a number of the papers today talk about the search for simple answers. And I think that's a huge, very understandable desire amongst people. Because you kind of want a simple answer that'll fix it and make it go away.
Okay.
And it just doesn't exist, I don't think.
But I think there are some issues that have come out of it that are quite legitimate. We might get into talking about them in a minute. Dara Doyle, you've young kids as well.
Yeah, my kids, oldest girl 15, a 12-year-old boy and a 10-year-old girl. So I suppose a couple of things. Like Niamh, I didn't engage with it at all during the trial, but I've read since. I mean, I recommend to anybody Conor Gallagher's piece in the Irish Times is exceptional journalism as a piece of work. And it certainly elicited a huge reaction for me. I suppose a couple of key things. Number one, like deep sadness for all the families involved, but particularly for Anna Creagell's family. What I found so hit home so personally was the idea that the mum comes home, she's not there, she texts the girl, no answer, she rings the girl, no answer, she keeps texting. To any kind of parent of teenage kids, that's a fairly familiar sort of moment where you don't know where your kids are. Mm. And it's I think, the most terrifying experience you can have as a parent, not knowing where your kids are. So that really hit home.
Normally it's fine.
Yeah. Absolutely. The other thing that really hit home with me in Conor Gallagher's piece is where he talked about, he compared it to Lyra McKee. Obviously, Anna had her difficulties as a teenager, as so many of us have when we're teenagers. But she was like, she loved dancing. She loved, she was a volunteer. And it was this idea that Lyra McKee expressed, you know, in her open letter, you know, so before she was so tragically taken, that things get better. So for Anna, things would have got much better. So it was, for me, I know we don't want to talk too much about the detail of the case, but it's those things which humanised Anna that made it really kind of significant. So the last thing I want to say, though, without wanting to kind of, I know we're going to get into this later on, I also determination not to kind of get swept away in a moral panic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very easy to take this as sort of symptomatic of a wider thing in our society, but to me, it reminded me a lot of the Jamie Bulger case. We saw it was 20 years ago. That hasn't been followed by a slew of similar such cases. Mm. To me, this is a horrendous outlier, but it's not something that's symptomatic of us.
Very, very, very rare thing
because
to happen.
What you don't want to do is kind of is to your teens and take away. You're trying to give them more freedom all the time.
Yes.
And to something like this, is very easy to kind of set that process back, but they need their independence to an extent. So maybe not overreact, I think, is it for me.
Absolutely. Jean Kelly?
Well, I've just one child and he's 10, so nothing about this trial was in any way possible to discuss with a child of that age. Exactly like my colleagues here have said, I was absolutely in the camp of people who had studiously avoided this trial in every form of media that I consume, and I consume a lot of media. I didn't set any filters to kind of block out that content from myself, but I just didn't come across it in the trial. And that was really for two reasons. Again, like Niamh, two reasons. Parent of a young child, this stuff is horrific for any parent. And the second reason is that I do think that trials work best in the courts, where they are, with the judges, with the jury, with the court officials and the police, who are equipped and trained to deal with these horrific scenarios so that the rest of us don't have to. So I had that great luxury, which unfortunately none of the families involved had, of being able to ignore this trial. And again, it was really at the time of the Conor Gallagher piece and post the conclusion of the trial that I started reading into it a bit more. And I think what comes across, and Jerry's beside me and has got clippings of the papers beside him, and you see these photographs of this amazingly luminous, treasured, longed for and, you know, clearly loved child, and that just came across so clearly in the parents' statement afterwards, and my heart goes out to them. They behaved with incredible dignity throughout the trial. I think Conor was on the radio yesterday saying that they hardly got up and got a bottle of water at the trial. One of their supporters did. They didn't flinch and they didn't miss a single piece of evidence. So that's extraordinary for anyone to have to go through.
And Gerard Howland, that humanity does come across in the papers today as well, doesn't it? And Anna has become more and more into focus as the focal point of this.
Yes, I suppose the poignancy of an adopted child and the poignancy of a child who clearly had great talent and great potential, but also had some challenges. And we've all been either bereaved ourselves or very close to people who have been bereaved. And there's something I just thought of in the last day or two, is that when the funeral is going on, people are very busy, and the full impact of whatever it is has happened doesn't sink in. And of course, for this family, there's a trial, and that trial is not complete. Hence, you know, our need to be extremely sensitive in everything we say about it. But at the end of the whole process of the funeral and then the trial, which is yet to be complete, has not yet arrived for them. And there will be a day when there will be no court to go to, when there will be no further proceedings to follow. Mm. Those days are close. And in a sense, I fear for them that the worst is yet to come.
Gauchi, in your thoughts?
It's a deeply, deeply troubling case. I think we do ourselves a great disservice if we don't treat it as a major wake-up call. I think it compels us to think about how we can better bring up younger people, better bring up children. I think the photographs today in the Sunday Independent remind us of the supreme importance of life and death. And they bring that home to us in a very, very real way. This is an absolute tragedy. But it also, I believe, forces us to ask fundamental questions about the kind of society we want and the kind of values we aspire to.
In general, among all our young people.
And these are all general discussions.
So I guess the first one of those then that jumps off the front page of the Sunday Independent is the Samantha Cochrane story of the first social media controls revealed. Gareth, what did you think about that? About the prospect of the BAI being in charge of all this? Is it workable?
Look, it strikes me as being an enormous task, a task that was going to require enormous resources. I think it's important. I think it's important that we attempt it, but I don't think laws are the only answer. If the laws help us, well then, well and good. But I think an awful lot of this comes back down to what you are effectively implying yourself today. And I'm not talking at all about this case. I'm talking in general about the absolute importance of giving parents every support in terms of the education of their children with regard to these matters.
Absolutely. And then on the other hand, there is an argument, Jean, that like parents are powerless against this massive thing that is the internet, social media, which has taken over our lives. As a digital lawyer, do you think it's possible at this stage to police it?
Yeah, I think it's possible to police it, but I think a lot of countries around the world have really struggled with a very core issue around this, and that is, if you take out our phone now, we tweet or we put something on Facebook, it takes approximately 5 to 10 seconds, depending on your keyboard speeds, to do that. It takes a lot longer to review that content and judge it against either a set of laws or standards as to whether it should have been posted or not. That's the fundamental mismatch. It's quick to do, it's difficult to review.
The argument would go then that these companies, and I know you've represented these companies, that their business model is built on something which fundamentally should be illegal. Is that not the argument here? Is it enough for them to put up their hands and say, look, guys, it's difficult to police this, so basically we can't?
I mean, I don't think it's... I think 20 years ago that was probably the thinking. I think the market and that those companies have all evolved now, and I think there is an awareness now that there is greater responsibility going to be put on those companies, not to proactively surveil for content before it goes up, because that's not technically possible, and the speed and volume of people on social media means it's not technically possible.
But this is the point I'm making. If it's not technically possible, is it enough to say, well, look, it's not technically possible, but we will continue to make absolute billions in profits, but look, it's not technically possible to police it, so there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think those companies don't throw their hands in the air and don't say that it's technically possible. I mean, they're increasingly well-resourced in this area, and I think that is only going to... That trend is only continuing. They're all like staffing up in their what they call the notice and kind of takedown teams. And I'm not an apologist for them. I think there's a lot that's very good in social media. For example, children with disabilities and that maybe have mobility issues have actually got a lot. And I've spoken to kind of young teens and older kids who found their voice in social media in a way that they didn't otherwise. So there's lots that's good around this. I don't think parents are powerless. I think parents have to really educate themselves in relation to not just social media, but online content that their kids are consuming. It's tricky stuff. It's distasteful stuff. I'm not talking about the trial at all. I'm talking just in general. I work in this area for a living, and I went to an information evening that my kids' school had in relation to online content a few months ago, and it was telling us about sites that I had no idea existed, social media platforms that I had no idea existed. So, you know, it's a constant job of work to remain up to date with this, and we are in the middle of it. One of the articles, I think it's the Business Post, calls a social experiment where we're trying to learn how to regulate this as we're consuming the content.
And which we have allowed these massive companies to access directly to our children in a way we never have with anything.
I personally feel that the distinction between being a publisher and a platform, which is essentially the no issue, I feel myself it's unsustainable. Mm. And I think the platform providers are going to run out of road, and I think they know it.
Just explain for people who aren't kind of media savvy what that distinction
is. So essentially, like if we look at conventional media, so we're here reviewing all the papers today, and those are regarded as publishers. So therefore, they're responsible for the content that they publish. So if somebody publishes something that's out of line, then there's recourse. At the moment, many of the social media providers maintain the distinction that they're essentially a platform, that they're just enabling people to publish, and that therefore they're not really responsible for the content. And this has been the nub that a lot of cases have boiled down to when people have sought to take action against the platforms
for
content.
And this came up in court again this week, didn't it?
And I feel myself that given the level of regulation that we subject the conventional media to, and given the regulation that we actually subject anybody who's now engaging with children to, I think to then in the middle of that hand them a device which is full of unregulated content, it's an anachronism, essentially.
But which could go back to the parents again.
Who I think, in fairness, Brendan, just on the parents issue, I mean, there's not just the question of like the privacy of the child and how does the privacy of the child balance with the adult, but there's a massive skills gap between parents and kids around this issue, which makes it much more difficult for them to regulate their behaviour.
Dara, but I just thought your language is quite interesting. You know, we're allowing these companies push this stuff to our children. Well, we're giving the children the phones to do that. And it kind of goes back to this Sunday Independent article. An Irish regulatory watchdog, which would police all video content on the world's biggest social media platforms, has set out new powers. I mean, it's like something that... No, there's no reflection of the BAI. It's like something out of Waterford Whispers, that the idea that Ireland would try and police all the video produced social media companies across the world.
It obviously needs to be staffed up a bit, but I think, in fairness, it seems to be that there will be, they will continue to rely on self-regulation within the companies, but that the BAI will oversee the self-regulation. Do we not have a situation at the moment where the Irish Data Protection Commissioner is largely responsible worldwide for...
Yeah, which is why I smiled when I saw the Irish Independent headline that said the first regulation of technology companies. I mean, anyone who's worked in my area for the last 20 years knows that they're, you know, all companies, including RT and everybody else, are regulated in relation to data privacy. And some of the solutions, interestingly, I think anyway, some of the solutions that people talk about, like age verification technologies, are actually hugely problematic from a privacy perspective. So this is naughty stuff. If you bring in age verification mechanisms, then you're creating a trail online for every website that someone has looked at as an adult. So that's, from a freedom of expression and, you know, civil society point of view, to me is very troubling. I don't know if it's more troubling than some of the content that's out there, but it's certainly one of those examples that the solution itself is very troubling, because the idea that age verification software may, you know, have this data trail of every site that you look at, that data itself is high risk data, and if that got into the wrong hands, you could see how that could be very dangerous both to children and adults.
But there's all that kind of data is available anyway, isn't it? And there have been many bad actors have accessed much of that data anyway. Gary Sheehan, what do you think?
No, well, I agree with you on that. I mean, what we have to get back and focus on is how do we create a healthy environment for our children, given all the risks that are there. And we have to do everything possible. And I don't think it's enough sometimes to say, well, look, we can't really do it, or it's too much, or whatever. We have to make the effort. It may not be enough, it may not work, but if it helps, then we've got to go after it. That seems to me to be the position.
Gerard Howland.
I think the BAI suggestion is a bit of a distraction, and the substance of what an agency should do is more important. I mean, to foist this on the BAI will be to put a task that is many, many, many times the size of the mission of the BAI onto it, and it will distract it from its core role of regulating broadcasting. But that aside, I think there's a very interesting piece in today's Sunday Independent by the Minister of State for Mental Health, Jim Daly. And what he is suggesting, and he's been at this for a year or two, is that there needs to be a much more intense verification process of people to get online. Because once you're online, the volume of stuff that can be pumped up there literally in an instant, you know, you're always running after it thereafter. But to get a car license, to get a passport, there are fairly rigorous, or to get a social welfare payment, there are fairly rigorous identity tests that have to be gone through, and they're now they're all totally normalised in our society. And what he is suggesting is that there will be an online verification code to upload yourself onto any of these platforms. He says he's spoken to the Data Protection Commissioner and it's feasible. I don't know enough to comment, but I think that's the sort of thing that we need to be looking at. Because once you're online, you can be 21, 41, 61. You can be male or female. You can be 5'1" or 6'2". You can have any image up there besides this identity as supposed proof of this personage you have created. Or in the case of most of us who have a name, our name which is our own, and a very clear face picture which is our own. You know, we just are who we say we are, but there's all these bogus identities that they need to be weeded out, so that at least you have traceability. to a known, identifiable, actual person for everything that goes up. And I think if we were looking at things from that end of the pipeline, it actually might be the tool that's nearest to us and most plausible to us to make the first big step on all of this.
Yeah, it does seem, though, that the process that happened this week was largely successful in terms of the identification of Boy A and Boy B, that Facebook had been working on it beforehand, and it was shut down very quickly, it seems. And it doesn't seem that their identification material with pictures, names and stuff are being posted anymore or are out there. So was that a successful example of those boys being protected?
I think there's two issues going on. There's the kind of, retrospective moves essentially that we kind of see this week, in fairness, it's not just this case where these kinds of issues have come up in an entirely different context. If you look at the anti-water charges cases where they came up about people tweeting from within the courts and the kind of impact that had, there's a range of issues here. I think myself, Brendan, just looking across the papers this morning, there's while what happened this week in a sense was welcome in kind of setting boundaries, I think the bigger issue is what happened before and earlier on, and the kind of exposure that all children, a bunch of the articles today make the point that, most kids like do their best and most parents do their best and people are just trying to get on with life. But unfortunately, we have to create safeguards for the situations where those things don't apply. Do you know what I mean? And this case has thrown up, has forced us, I think very much as Gareth says, to ask those questions. Do you know what I mean? About what do we do in situations where those givens don't apply, or we don't even realise they don't apply until things have all gone wrong. And I think they are important questions, and I don't think we can run away from them. I think they'll be with us for a while. I think the solutions will take time to develop. But I agree with Gareth. I think we must find them. I think we must find them.
As a sociologist, the pornography epidemic that we seem to be witnessing now, do you have a take on it?
Well, it's interesting. I was looking at some of the data this morning. Kate Dawson in NUI Galway, she had a study out recently which showed that 53% of boys first see porn between the ages of 10 and 13, and 23% of girls. Now, I suppose, as a sociologist or a parent, as somebody who works in the space of education, I mean, we have to ask ourselves as a society if that's a stat we're happy to live with. One of the big issues that's coming in, and certainly in the sector that I work in HEI, is around the area of consent. And a number of people working in the area of consent will now say to you, it's too late when you come in at third level to start giving classes and consent and starting. And there's an education piece to it. Just let's be very clear about this. You can set all the boundaries and have all the kind of legal side to it all. There's still an education piece to it. But we're coming to this game far too late, given that there are so many kids in this country who get phones for their confirmation or indeed phones for their communion.
And yeah. Ciara Kelly makes the point today in her piece that when you think your child is old enough to see pornography and you're happy for them to see it, that's when you give them a phone, because damn right, as soon as you give them a phone, they're going to see pornography, which is a depressing thought.
Can I just get in there? And I think that raises a very important point, because I think a lot of sort of potential government interventions, they tend to have a marginal impact at best. And without wanting to, I shouldn't be a hypocrite here, but a lot of it goes back to parents. Well, if a parent is giving a smartphone to a 9-year-old or 10-year-old, they have a responsibility to try and see what the kid is doing on that line. Now, I'm not great at that. My methods of talking to my son about it is, we watch some YouTube and I ask him, Leo, is that appropriate? And he says, yeah, it's fine, Dad. And that, which is not exactly a foolproof way of doing it. But I think it is, often in society we have something like this happen. We come up with this, the government must do something. Somebody else must do something to sort this out. I suspect a lot of the main way of dealing with this is at home, setting boundaries for your kids, trying to check in what they're doing, at signs of a bit of independence. I think looking for somebody else to solve these problems isn't going to happen if you're not prepared to do it yourself. If you're giving a kid, a 9-year-old, a smartphone,
Then on the other hand, a lot of people have very good safety reasons and everything else for wanting their kids
absolutely
to have a phone.
Well, they could have an old Nokia instead of an iPhone.
Yeah, and there is a lot of it going on. I think a lot of people are giving their kids so-called dumb phones at an early age, and it seems like a sound idea.
But we're talking about all this in the context of everything that's relatively new, which is smartphones and internet and all the rest, but it's also something that's incredibly old. There was none of this when I was in primary school, but I remember the schoolyard as a very wild, feral place. I can remember, horrific incidences of bullying. There's one particular classmate of mine when I was in second and third class in primary school, and I've often wondered, it was an all boys school. Where is he, and how did it end? It was horrific. It was shameful. It's a very, disturbing memory. The way two or three kids were consistently picked on, and one in particular. I have very happy memories of secondary school. It was a very relaxed. I don't remember anything similar. But that whole Lord of the Flies thing, it was written for a reason. That children at that age in groups, it can be intensely jungle-like and feral. And then you put the rocket fuel of all this technology on top of that. But the technology doesn't cause it. Because if you're old enough to remember the time before any of this, you should have the wit to remember that with no technology, that all the same impulses were there.
But Derek, I think we should be clear as well. Teenagers can be cruel, but teenagers can also be absolutely fantastic.
I can remember a secondary school situation, but I remember a primary school situation. So I'm just saying that it can be there.
Absolutely.
And there you go. It's another.
You were looking at the Sunday Business Post. Post Plus has a piece celebrating individuality and diversity can reduce.
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrific piece. It's a kind of academic piece by Professor James O'Higgins Norman, I think the gentleman's name is. And the point that he makes, which may sound obvious but hadn't occurred to me before I read it, is that if you have a culture at home and in schools of celebrating individual diversity, it reduces bullying. That's demonstrable in the research, apparently. And I think the other article that Niamh mentioned there from the lady in NUIG mentioned that children from poorer backgrounds and children from migrant families are much more likely to be bullied. I think that's very telling about how we educate our kids and how we talk to kids about fitting into the group. And actually, this thought process came to me late on Thursday when I saw that story in the UK about the MP and the climate change protester. 200 people sat there in tuxes. A lot of them were in tuxes, anyway, the men were. And they watched someone body slam someone against a pillar and lift them out of a room. And some people didn't even turn around during that. That this societal demand to be polite and to be quiet and to be kind of well got, if you like, is not the be-all and end-all. You do have to kind of teach your kids sometimes that... To step in. And there's something called good trouble as well that John Lewis talks about in the US. So, always using the right knife and fork and looking well in the tux is not the best behaviour, I think.
Right, Shane?
I suppose it reminds me a little bit about the great debt we owe the GAA and all those soccer coaches who are out there every Sunday morning in winter and summer and bad weather, and they have girls teams and boys teams from the age of 7 or 8 up. I often wonder, if it wasn't for all that input, where would we be? I think they give a great service to the country.
And a lot of the time, instead of focusing on the bad things and what we should be doing about them, a lot of the time it's just about putting in loads of good things and crowding out the bad things, isn't it? And that can be just as effective. Niamh, before we leave this, you looked at a piece in the Sunday Independent on page 23, and you wanted to talk about the anxiety around this, and also the notion of society and shame being something that is part of what society wants out of a result of a situation. And we'd be very careful how we talk about it, but I think it's an interesting point.
Yeah, you see, I suppose so. It's very interesting when you have the fallout from a case like this, because on one hand you're trying to balance the fact that it's still a live case and be careful around what you say. But I suppose for me as a sociologist, one of the things that it's important to recognise is that moral outrage happens very commonly, and it serves a purpose, and it's about reaffirming essentially the boundary, that essentially that there are things which essentially we regard as outliers, I think, Dara, as you said. And that sense of outrage does serve that. Now, it's about the question of then how that's expressed and where that goes. In my view, the good piece about it is if it can go into lessons learned, if it can go into facing up to the big questions that we kind of have run away from. I agree with Gerard that actually there's impulses here that are always there. They're a part of the human condition. But, you know, as we've seen, for instance, in the US in the debate about gun control, you know, there's a state piece to how you manage those impulses. And there's also then an educational piece. And I think there's, but you know, the public piece of this, and it's been extraordinarily difficult to watch and to see, and I think for the courts to manage, that it serves a purpose in itself, because that's what justice is about, and justice being seen to be done, you know. So it's very important to recognise that. I think the outrage that people feel is part of kind of natural instinct at some level here.
Okay, and just to underline, I did make this point earlier, that Judge White during the week made a number of rulings in relation to Twitter and Facebook, as we know, but he did make the point that the Central Criminal Court is not the forum for the wider issue of whether social media sites are responsible for what appears in them. He said that his court was not the forum for it, and of course he was right. And we'll take a break then.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Gareth Sheehan, Gene Kelly, Niamh Horrigan, Dara Doyle and Gerard Howland. And now, lots of the papers as well about the our great environmental plan, which is going to change everything. Jean, you were looking at a piece in the Sunday Business Post, interest groups get to work picking off bits of the Cabinet's climate action plan. This is even before the plan happened.
They're circling the wagons. This is a really detailed piece over a couple of pages dealing with all different aspects of the climate change plan, or as they call it in The Guardian, the climate emergency plan. Everything from retrofitting, the cost of retrofitting older homes, all homes, electric vehicles, the improvement in the network for charging for vehicles, as well as farming and the agriculture issue as well. So it's a really detailed
and
piece.
Their point being that, for example, the farmers were in, and that there's no plan. It'll probably happen naturally anyway as a result of a lot of these things, but no plan to reduce the national herd, for example.
Yeah, apparently not.
Builders, that they maybe got a delay on the changing over of boilers, is that right?
Yeah, I can't remember what the year ended up being, but certainly we're looking at kind of boilers, traditional gas and oil boilers being made legal in about, I think, 15 years' time, something like that.
So. Yeah, but in fairness, I think there is probably a lot of training to be done. There are a lot of very specialised guys who deal with boilers at the moment, and there's a lot of people who've just put boilers into their houses as well.
There's a lot of green energy jobs as well. I know we're approaching, functionally high employment, or maybe full employment, but it's very clear there's going to be a very significant spend in this regard, so we're going to see a lot of kind of high-end engineering jobs around retrofitting everyone's homes. And
I'm not sure Ger Connor in the Daily Mail or Mail Sunday would agree. He calls Leo's planned whole thing, quote, is a con trick. It's shameless, dull and stupid because it lacks a time's morsel of credibility. So I'm not sure Ger Connor would agree that there's really much to it beyond that.
Okay, and that's sure enough concisely expressed. Or Ger Connor's. Ger Howland, what's your opinion? No,
that's not the same as Ger Connor's. Just to be clear about this. Look, it is a start. It is the first serious plan we have. It is anemic in places. It is woolly in places, but it is the government's attempt to do enough to show cause before an election without having to do anything that would cause eruption before an election. It is one budget between the election, and that will be the test, not what's in the plan, what's in the budget. Because the plan is what I say I will do. The budget is what I do. So that's the single litmus test for this government on this issue in its lifetime.
Niamh.
Yeah, the best piece for my money is actually one by Colm McCarthy in the Sunday Independent. And essentially what he picks out is a couple of key things. First of all, the fact that the plan has a lot of targets rather than policies. And he said you'd want to be rather naive to recognise the difference between a target and a policy. The second point is picking up really on Gerard's, the lack of costing on a lot of the measures. So, for instance, if you take the idea of putting a million electric cars on the road by 2030, there's the whole question of the current subsidies that are for electric cars and whether they're sustainable in terms of exchequer costing. There's also the question of charging. So the electricity to power the electric cars has to come from stations. We lack charging points. So there's a lot of very tangible, fine grain that really isn't there.
The point was continually made during the week that if we want to hit the target on electric cars of 950,000 by, is it 2030, that basically every car bought in Ireland from now till then would need to be an electric car. And obviously we're miles off that. Jean, you drive an electric car.
Kilometres.
You drive an electric car.
I do.
I know a lot of people who went early adapters, very green people who went in early and are now very bitter and angry about it.
I've had those moments on the M50 sometimes when I get range anxiety and I see 17 kilometres on my battery and a lot of traffic. And yeah, I switched to electric. We're a one car household and I live close to the city centre, so I had the luxury of going electric. And my son, be like a lot of young children, is a avid environmentalist and wants me to leave some element of a planet for him. So he was nagging us a little bit about looking into electric, so we decided we would. And it, because of the range, because of the typical journey I do is quite small, it was possible. But I mean, it has its challenges, and the charging network, while it's much improved, isn't great. And the more people that get electric vehicles, the more likely you are to have to wait sometimes to charge. I have home charging, so it makes it easy for me. But yeah, I wouldn't go back to a petrol car, but I've had some moments where I've kind of wished I was in a Range Rover V8.
So you're happy enough, Gareth?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. I think it's a start. I think it's an important start. I think it's not something that any government is going to be able to shelve, because this is being driven by young people. I have to say that I agree with Pat Leahy, who wrote in the Irish Times on Saturday that the government, if they're to implement these plans, are going to have to take some very hard decisions, and some people will not, these decisions won't suit some people. But hard decisions will be required.
I suspect that Leo has looked to what happened to Macron in France, who I think the yellow vest movement was...
Yes, there will be a string vest movement.
So I think what he's trying to do is strike a balance. I'm possibly more cynical than a lot of other people. I think Irish people might say they've got the desire to be green, but do they really want to pay for it? Mm. So I think what Leo is trying to say is, we're able to do some stuff here, but it's not going to cost you very much because you probably don't really want to pay for it. And we go back to, you and I have discussed water charges many times, I think, on the show. And, that's true. Irish people were not prepared to pay for something which could be argued to be environmentally friendly.
But do you not think, Dara, that there is... One of the things that was really striking for me in the outcome of the local and European elections was age, an age demographic. Yeah. And if you break down those votes by age, you really do start to see some striking trends, not only towards the Greens, but also towards the Social Democrats and other parties. And you also see some of the established parties really losing out in some of the young age categories. So I suppose there is a long-term issue for Leo and anyone who wants to be in government, is that one of the things that's really interesting about that age group now is because of a number of events that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years, they're very politicised, more politicised, I would say, than the previous generation, and I think possibly more likely to vote and use that vote.
Well, politicised on issues, I guess. And the Green Party are an issue. And do you want to declare any interest in
my sister was one of the councillors elected on the Green Wave, so we're surfing the Green Wave at the moment in our family.
But
I have to say, my dad was a Fine Gael councillor for years, so there's a balance of interest.
But I wonder, do people vote for the Greens in the local and European elections because they feel like it's a nice thing to do and it's not really got any serious consequences? Will that translate into a national
election? In an analysis of the exit poll, it turns out where you had various sorts of shy voters who weren't declaring what they'd actually done, significantly more people claimed to have voted Green than did. So there's a fashion about this. And in relation to the next generation...
I think someone mentioned at the time that possibly their children were with them when they were asked at the exit poll.
Yeah. And Niamh was absolutely right. And Gareth, there is a generational thing here, and that gives real hope. But there's a long time to go, because the people paying the bills that will have to be significantly increased to make the changes are not the younger ones. It is their parents who claim falsely that they voted Green when in fact they hadn't. And Niamh mentioned another point about the long term. In politics, the long term is the next election.
Well, there's always historically been a pattern in Ireland of a distinction between votes in local and European elections and general elections. So the general election will be the acid test, I think, of whether we're seeing any meaningful shift. But, you know, one of the things that we look from international experience, particularly if you look, for instance, at Obama and others, that if you can get a new age cohort to vote for you or any new cohort, you do then change the landscape, you know what I mean? And that, if that follows through, that will make a difference.
Well, political parties are lining up to pick holes in this, particularly, for example, you have carbon charges. There's a whole range of smaller parties on the left who want to make that, for their own political purposes, new water charges. And the carbon charges will have to go from €20 per tonne to €80 per tonne by 2020. And if that is to have any meaning, that must begin on Budget Day this year. And you wait...
And of course, they've already shirked it in one budget, haven't they?
Absolutely. But you wait to see the reaction in the Dáil Chamber if this is done, not in hours, within nanoseconds, of this will be claimed to be a tax on the poor, a tax on this, a tax on that, and there will be immediate rallying of marches and all the rest.
There's a lot of interest.
And by the way, we're only one of three countries in Europe that does not have a tax on domestic electricity. And we've no water charges, and we have an anemic property charge, and we are nowhere near the sort of reality that will get us to where we need to go, and that is before anyone has the self-shaming experience of looking in their kitchen cupboard or their bathroom cupboard for the amount of once-off useless stuff they've accumulated to pollute the planet.
So you're saying there's a steep learning curve ahead of us.
Steep and painful.
There's interesting little sidebars to this as well. Like, there's a thread running through the papers today, and Jerry, you were looking at a piece in the Sunday Business Post about data centres.
Yes, so obviously, data is a big business in Ireland, you know, Google and Intel and all these people. And while we do not have a tax on domestic electricity, we do have on commercial electricity. And a specific proposal in this plan is to double that from 50 cents an hour to €1 per hour, or sorry, for a megawatt hour. I have to admit, I actually don't understand what a megawatt hour is, but the critical point is doubling it. And that will add a very significant bill to that electricity, the cost of business, the cost of employment and all the rest. And this is just a taster, a small taster, of this myriad realities that come with this. This is expensive.
But just remember, Apple, Athenry lost the Apple data centre because of some environmental objections. I think if you ask the vast majority of people in Athenry, not all, but I've reported quite a lot on that story, vast majority of people in Athenry were in favour of data centre being built.
Oh, you know, indeed.
But my wide point is that there's choices involved, and it's fine if we make the choices, but we have to make those choices and realise that there's costs to making policy decisions around the climate as well. And if you're losing your job, or your son has to move from Athenry to the States or to London because the job they could have had in the Apple Data Centre is gone,
what you'll find is that nobody will march against the doubling of the tax on the data centres because none of us pay it directly. Yeah. But come the tax on our bale of briquettes or our bag of coal, wait till see how that goes down.
I think what's going to be interesting in Dublin in particular is we see a lot of kind of Green Party, I think in particular, had a lot of very interesting female candidates, first time round election candidates. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that some of them are going to be TDs at the time of the next election. The traditional dichotomy was always you'll vote for someone in the locals, you may not vote for them in a national election. I think there's a few, maybe they're outlier candidates, maybe I'm in a bubble, we all are, I'm sure, but I've no doubt that some of those are going to be TDs in fairly short order.
In Dublin, I'd say the situation could be a bit different out in rural Ireland.
A small number of Green TDs, there are two at the moment, even if there were four or six, could actually be a pivotal number to ensure significant policy change in the next Dáil.
Yeah, and there's a lot floating around about tectonic shifts in the political alignments today. So,
Forget the tectonic shifts. You only need one or two Dáil deputies that are absolutely necessary to get that Taoiseach across the line, to have that Taoiseach by the part of his anatomy that will cause the most attention.
And according to the Sunday Times, and according to, I think there's another story in the Sunday Business Post, that Taoiseach who gets across the line with the Greens, they're potentially saying could be Micheál Martin, that there is this alignment going on in Dublin, am I right?
Yeah, so this is two separate pieces in the Sunday Independent. By the way, the Irish Examiner has a series on political parties every Monday, starting last week with Sinn Féin. Tomorrow it's Fianna Fáil, and I have a piece on precisely that issue there then. But the point is that Fianna Fáil is actually in contention. Micheál Martin is in contention. That's a remarkable fact, given what happened in 2011, when they were on the verge of complete extinction. It's the first election since 2007 where there will be a real contest of power to be the lead party in government. There wasn't in 2011, and there wasn't, contrary to what was said by Fianna Fáil, in 2016 either. Now, Fine Gael lost a lot more than it needed to in 2016 because they ran a bad campaign. But this is the first real election since 2007 when there will be a real contest. It has all the signs of being incredibly close, and that is some turn up for the books.
Liam Weeks in the Sunday Indoor today, you were looking at that.
Yeah.
He's kind of disrupting this narrative that has hold that Fianna Fáil have been forgiven, and he says far from it, really.
Yeah, he crunches some numbers and he basically says, look, if we look at the pre-2011 and post-2011, Fianna Fáil are still 30 fewer TDs and 100 fewer councillors. I suppose that there's a kind of companion piece on the other side that talks about the way in which that the government essentially see the threat posed by Sinn Féin as receding, and therefore they're focusing more now on Fianna Fáil as the major threat. I have to say,
and this is in the Sunday Indoor, the election sniping has started.
One of the comments I thought was most interesting actually last week in the interview that the Taoiseach did with you on Saturday morning, which was kind of an observation really, and he talked about the travelling of votes in North Dublin from Sinn Féin back to Fianna Fáil. For me, as a political sociologist, that's a really interesting trajectory to look at what will happen to those votes and where they could go potentially in a general election.
But in no sense, just one thing about that. I think people are beginning to realise now that the Brian Cowan-led government took hard decisions from which we've ultimately benefited. And I think people are also beginning to realise that when we talk
about... I think equally there's a lot of people out there who say that government was a disaster.
Well, that was a Green, weren't the Greens in partnership with
but
with
that
Fianna
we saw, that I mean, the last days of that government,
so
a lot of people would say that Fianna Fáil had played a big part in destroying this country, and that that Brian Cowan government and the latter days of it, when we needed a government that was really, you know, tough and on it, that government was adrift. Like.
Well, I thought that, I mean, that Brian Cowan took hard decisions. And decisions that were in the interests of the people, and certainly not in the interests of Fianna Fáil at the time. And I think people will also remember him in due course for the role he played in the peace process.
In fairness, Gareth, I mean, with the greatest respect, at that point Brian Cowan had absolutely no choices. He didn't have choices. I mean, the international money markets were charging 15 to 20% to lend Ireland money. You don't have a choice.
Sorry, the one choice he did have...
You don't have a choice at that
point.
The
one choice he did have, and I accept your point, by the way, because I worked in that Fianna Fáil government and I contributed to a lot of the problems, and I want to acknowledge that. But the one choice Brian Cowan had, which was that he could have gone to the country earlier, he could have reduced somewhat the scale of what happened to Fianna Fáil subsequently, and he persisted against the advice and wishes of some of his parliamentary colleagues in keeping in year after year to the end with all the consequences that came.
Okay.
He did no more than his duty, but he did
do
his duty.
Do we honestly think, though, that people out there, so many of them lost their jobs, people lost their houses, people like their lives were destroyed, that they are now ready after
let's be clear about the scale of comeback. There's never a going back for Fianna Fáil. That will never ever come again. Fianna Fáil, depending on what poll you want to believe, are at 26, 27, 28%. That's so far short of the 40 they were used to. That will never come back. The two big parties combined will share a total of the vote between 55 and 60%. That's what's at stake to be the lead to form the next government. So it's in no way back to what was. It's simply a repositioning via Fine Gael of who is leading for the much reduced share of the two main parties.
Gina, I give you the last word on this.
Last word, and that is, I think, for me as a kid of 70s, it's interesting to see the fall of Sinn Féin, and the drop has been, you know, remarkable. It's really not commented on hugely widely. Noel Whelan had a really good piece, I think, in the Times about 2-3 weeks ago on this. And I think that's the big story, I think, really. I haven't seen that piece about the kind of kind of migration of votes from them to Fianna Fáil in North Dublin. I'd love to read it. But that to me is very interesting because I feel that's a long time overdue.
Although I remember Gerry Ireland's words, they haven't gone away.
Is it a long time overdue? I mean, this is a party that was growing and growing. They've hit some kind of a glitch at the moment. But does that really mean they're finished now?
No, but I think they're much reduced on, and I doubt they'll be back at where they were.
For the time being, and we've seen them before in reduced, and we've seen them before coming back as well. Okay, we're going to take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Thanks, Ciara. Our panel is still here. Gareth Sheehan, Gene Kelly, Niamh Horrigan, Dara Doyle and Gerard Howland. And it's time to talk about Boris. So obviously, I think barring some kind of an unforeseen disaster at this stage, it seems that most people think Boris is a dead cert to be the next Prime Minister. So to his critics, he's a fool. He plays fast and loose with the truth. And other people argue that he's brilliant. He has an extraordinary ability to work a crowd. And we certainly saw that yesterday at the hustings. It was extraordinary to see him in action. I'm joined now from London by Sonia Purnell, who's written a biography of Boris called Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. Sonia, you're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
You have a piece in the Sunday Times today, and I think the headline probably says it all. I know too well the fire and fury lurking behind that smile. And you talk about Boris's quick temper is one of the things you talk about in there.
Yes. I mean, you know, there are many Borises. I mean, there's obviously the jovial, joke-cracking, amusing Boris Johnson that people see and who has managed to court millions of people who love him, some even idolise him. But then there's also a very different Boris Johnson who you might see in private particularly.
And you were Boris's deputy in the Telegraph Bureau in Brussels.
That's right, back in the 90s, and this is when the Maastricht Treaty was going through, so it was sort of another kind of period of turmoil. We were working pretty hard, and you get to see someone, in all their glory, as it were, in those circumstances. I got to know him pretty well, and I also saw that temper, and it was frightening. Yeah, there's no other word for it.
Tell us about the 4 o'clock rants.
Okay, so Boris Johnson is famous, and rightly so. They were very creative pieces that he was writing from Brussels around the time that I was there. But they were very creative, and they bent the truth to the point sometimes where it snapped altogether. And, you know, actually deep down, I think Boris Johnson really is quite a sort of a sympathetic figure when it comes to the EU. So he had to try and work himself up into a little bit of a frenzy to write these things. And every day, more or less about 4 o'clock, which is why they became known as the 4 o'clock rants, he would lock himself in his office and I kid you not, and he admits this is true, shout abuse at a yucca plant, four-letter words, flying through the air very loud. You could hear it in my office next door. You could hear it in the street out loud. And he would just shout and shout and shout at this plant. And then eventually the shouting would stop and you'd hear him sit down and thump out one of these pieces at incredible speed. I mean, his focus is extraordinary. The poor Tandy laptop, I mean, fortunately it was built like a tank, so it withstood this treatment. But I remember one occasion he admitted, and I think he's admitted in print too, that the 4 o'clock rant was so sort of crazy that he pressed a biro into his palm so hard he actually drew blood. It was a very, very strange thing to witness, I have to say.
And I've seen people make the point, and Matthew Paris made it yesterday again in the Times, that this is essentially the essence of who Boris is, which is that he's a newspaper columnist who will, you know, say what he needs to say at the time with complete conviction in order to entertain, stimulate an audience, and that he's brought that into his politics.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he is always looking for the headline, and he's always pandering in a sort of Trump-like way to his base, so he can come up with stuff that we know not to be true. He talks about, you know, the implementation period after no deal, where I think, you know, most of us realise that there is no such thing, but he keeps repeating it as if it was a newspaper headline, and he doesn't expect any more scrutiny than he would as a journalist, in fact probably rather less scrutiny. So he's using those techniques that he learned as a columnist way back in Brussels during those 4 o'clock rants to keep people on site, that they don't press them too far, and even indulge some of the things that we've learned about in the last 48 hours.
Now, what we have learned about them in the last 48 hours is basically that there was a row with his girlfriend at his house. Boris is refusing to answer any questions. Do you think is it having any impact on him? It certainly didn't look as if it was yesterday.
Well, again, I think it's a sort of the difference between the country at large and his base. It seems now almost to the point it's a sort of a cult personality that he has, is that people refuse to think anything ill of him. If they hear something ill of him, they don't care. But I think there's a difference between that and having any credibility with the people at large, with the fact that he won't answer questions about it, the fact that a woman did sound distressed, did sort of shout, you know, get off me, get out of my flat, it is her flat and that you're spoiled, and there was a row about red wine on the sofa. I mean, these aren't great things, and for it to be so loud that people could hear it, you know, outside the flat and called the police. I mean, this isn't normal behaviour.
Did you witness Boris's temper when you work with him?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why all of these years, I have to say, been terrified at the idea of him in power. I did witness that temper. It was directed to me on at least one occasion.
That occasion.
Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary thing. It was when his wife Marina was in labour with her first child, Lara, and she called me in tears from the labour room saying that she couldn't find Boris anywhere. Well, obviously, as another woman, I did everything I could to try and track him down. I ran around Brussels trying to find him. We didn't have proper mobile phones in those days. It was in the early 1990s, but I tried to contact him on his pager. Couldn't think of any other way. She called again in great distress. So I called the foreign desk at the newspaper in London and said, do you know where Boris is? Marina's in labour. I need to get a hold of him quickly. And then he said, oh, we didn't know she was pregnant. But yeah, he's actually on his way back to Brussels now. And so in the end, we managed to get him to the hospital on time. And the next day when he came to work, I seen that he'd be overjoyed as a father for the first time. And he directed this fury at me that I had no right to tell the desk that Marina was pregnant. And that was when I saw this extraordinary temper. I thought I'd done the right thing. I still think I'd done the right thing. Who else would have acted differently? But I had said something he'd not given me permission to say, it was pretty frightening, I can tell you.
You talk in your piece today as well about Boris within his own family of origin, a lot of fighting and temper as well.
Yeah. His Stanley's father, so Boris's father was renowned for a short fuse. And yes, after losing a point at table tennis against his sister, I mean, he's uber competitive. He was so frustrated that he kicked the wall so hard he broke a toe. Outside the family, one of his former secretaries at the House of Commons told me that 80% of the time working for him was fine, even, you know, fun. But 20% was frightening because of this temper and the way that he would bang his fist down so hard on the desk, he nearly broke a bone. On at least one occasion. So this is the flip side, if you like, of the jovial Boris Johnson that you see in public.
But there is the other flip side then, that you see in action yesterday, and you say it's his base, Sonia, but I guess his base is pretty big. Like it certainly takes in most of the Tory MPs, and there's huge public support for him as well, I think, in terms of people think that, you know, he's the guy to deliver Brexit and he's the guy to win an election if necessary and banish Corbyn. What do you put this extraordinary popularity down to?
Well, I think taking the Tory MPs for a second there, I mean, I think a lot of them, until very recently, were saying that, you know, they'd rather eat glass, I think one of them put it, than support Boris Johnson. But I think there was a sort of a campaign. I mean, Matthew Paris, the columnist, has talked about threatening to use private information against some of them. Some of them also see that they're going to lose their seats or think they're going to lose their seats unless Boris Johnson is in charge. So I'm not sure that you can really say he's he's hugely popular across the whole of the parliamentary party. In fact, I would dispute that. I think within the party members, we're talking about the figure is disputed, but somewhere between 120,000 and 160,000 Tory members who will decide whether or not he becomes the next prime minister. Well, we know from polling that they tend to be, you know, older in life, they tend to be white, they tend to be male, they tend to be quite well off, and they tend to be so obsessed with Brexit that they are prepared to trash the economy, break up the union, even see their party disintegrate in order to have Brexit. And Boris Johnson has persuaded them that he is the man to deliver it, even though actually we're still waiting for a plan and an understanding as to why he thinks he can do it when Theresa May didn't. So though obviously he is popular in some quarters, but I think he is now the Marmite politician. He wants you to be the Heineken politician. He could reach beyond the Tory party to metropolitan liberals, all sorts of people. I think that's much less the case now. He's a Marmite politician. You either love him or you loathe him, and that will be a problem for him at some point.
You mentioned dirty tricks that are supposed to have happened in terms of getting people to vote for him. You do talk in your piece today as well about he was always a very vengeful person who wanted to punish people who crossed him, and I think we maybe saw that a bit with Michael Gove during the week.
Yes, I mean, even his own sister Rachel again describes him as very Sicilian in the way that he holds grudges, and people are quite frightened of him. I mean, I mentioned again in that Sunday Times piece the wife of a really quite eminent figure now who was in the Bullingdon Club with Boris Johnson. She said, oh, he'll never speak to you. He knows a lot, but he'll never speak to you because he's terrified of what Boris will do to you. And a lot of people have warned me to be, you know, very careful. But I cannot believe in Britain in 2019 that, you know, one should be scared. One has to speak out. I think it's a duty to do so.
A lot of people making more and more comparisons between Boris and Trump all the time. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Yes, I think there are lots of... I think Boris takes a lot of the sort of the pages out of the Trump playbook. And in a way, he's just as talented as Trump in pandering to his base, but also just saying things that are patently untrue, such as the implementation period after a no-deal Brexit. If you say these things often enough, enough people start to believe them that you can get away with it. And this, again, is the sort of thing that Trump does.
Is there a sense at all, Sonia, though, that people think, here's a guy who's unburdened with principles, he's a guy who has been obsessed with getting into Downing Street, and that he will do whatever he needs to succeed on whatever level so that actually he could end up being a good result for people?
Yeah, no, I can see that you know, there is some strength in that argument. And I can also see that because of his genius with a crowd and getting, you know, empathising with the crowd, bringing unlikely people on side, that if somehow he could drop all these negative things about him, he could do great good. I mean, either whether you think that that means implementing Brexit or you think that that means stopping Brexit. This is the tragedy of Boris Johnson. He is incredibly talented in so many ways, and yet all of those talents so far have really been put to the greater glory of Boris Johnson rather than for his country.
And what about as Mayor of London? Did he not bring his talents to doing a good job at that, we're told?
Yeah, during the Olympics. I mean, during the Olympics, he was great. He really did help. It seemed such fun, such joy. I mean, he didn't bring the Olympics in, he didn't organise them, but he was part of that atmosphere in London in 2012, which we still remember as being, you know, a real golden time. But otherwise, really, during his mayoralty, even his own side said that he was a do-nothing mayor. And the problems that London has, the homelessness, pollution, congestion, really weren't tackled. He didn't bring anything new. That was very much his predecessor, Ken Livingstone, whether that was the congestion charge or the Oyster card or the Olympics themselves, or even Boris bikes, which really should have been called Ken bikes.
But Andrew Gilligan was writing in the Sunday Times last week, and he worked with Boris when he was Mayor of London. And, you know, this thing about, oh, Boris doesn't do detail. Andrew Gilligan was saying, well, look, it's not the mayor's job to do detail. It's the mayor's job to put in a good team who will do a good job. And he's about the general direction, tone and the vision thing. And Boris kind of has that, doesn't he?
Well, yes and no. If you have a look at the beginning of his term in London, and he arrived with no team in place, so a team had to be scrambled. And those first few months and even a year or so were marked by a series of sackings over sort of alleged racism and lying and resignations and even a criminal conviction amongst those people he brought in. Someone else, in the end, was parachuted in by the party to run London. Now, you know, that's one thing with a city of 8 million people altogether, another thing with a country of 65 million people.
Now, I suppose a question that we're obviously very invested in over here as well is what Boris is going to ultimately do about Brexit. Do you think that he's going to crash out no matter what on October 31st?
I mean, I don't know. And this is where, again, I think you have to be details man to be Prime Minister right now, because Brexit is all about detail. And this is why Britain has failed repeatedly in its negotiations. It was never on top of the detail as compared with Michel Barnier. I think it's impossible to know. I think that any responsible Prime Minister, to be honest, whether it's the whole problem over the border or whether it's medicines in the hospitals or fresh food in the shops, which responsible Prime Minister could possibly press ahead with no deal? It would be a catastrophe, both for Britain and for Ireland. I just find it extraordinary that any serious politician could even contemplate it.
OK, unless it is what the people say they want. Gerard Howland, Boris Johnson, either the best thing that could happen us in Ireland or the worst thing that could happen us?
Well, I don't see there's much prospect of him being a good thing, frankly.
You don't think that is pragmatism? You know, people say this could be the guy who could actually deliver on the withdrawal deal? Or
yeah, so there's a lot of examples in history where people who have led movements and are masters of them are actually the only ones who can effectively compromise, because they're only ones who can control most of what they have created or whipped up. So in that sense, if there could be a compromise, perhaps Boris is the only one who can deliver it. But he has walked himself into a very long, narrow cul-de-sac. I mean, I'm not remotely surprised that this is happening, because, you know, the MPs who may have wanted to eat glass rather than kiss Boris, they're facing an election of annihilation, and there's nothing like an execution to concentrate the mind. And I think a lot of that comes from there. There's all these hustings to go. We don't know what revelations will come in the coming weeks. But people should remember, I mean, compared to Lord Melbourne, Boris's morals make him look like an altar boy.
And he clearly has. I'm getting that, Sonia, you're not a huge fan of Boris, but Gerard, he does seem to have a lot of qualities that appeal to a lot of people.
He has extraordinary ability and charisma, and as regards detail and command of it, he has. His whole project is Project Boris. That is his life's work, and there has been no politician comparable to him, really, that I can remember. I mean, even the last great iconic British politician, Margaret Thatcher, she was an extraordinarily contained, disciplined person, you know, who eschewed all, you know, extravagance in personal behaviour or lifestyle. So there's nothing like this before. But I suppose the thing about Boris to remember is, and this is the critical thing for him, it will not be in October in relation to Brexit, because that's so enormous, we're understandably totally focused on it. But the bigger issue for him and for us is actually behind Brexit. It is sustainability of the United Kingdom outside the European Union. And as big as Brexit is, that will be much bigger and permanent for us.
OK, Dara.
Yeah, I just want to get in here, this idea that, and I think Dermot Farrell in the Irish Times write about this as well, and Michael McDill today, and this idea that Boris, with his charm, will be able to sell the current withdrawal agreement. The reality is the DUP are still going to be there. OK, the 10 votes DUP hold are absolutely crucial. They're not going to be bought off by Boris's charm. I mean, this whole idea of sticking, what's the phrase, lipstick on a pig, trying to sort of rejig the deal a little bit, the DUP won't be bought off by Boris's charm. So I know, talking to at least a few of the Irish officials in the recently, they now see the possibility of no deals as almost inevitable. That's definitely not a consensus view, but there's now a sort of sense of deep pessimism amongst Irish officials. And again, talking to somebody who claims to know Boris's thinking, they saw Theresa May's downfall being her failure to leave on March, the end of March. And Boris determined not to repeat that same mistake, so he was determined to leave in October. The DUP are not going to back the backstop, no matter who the Prime Minister is. Mm-hmm. So Boris's charm, fantastic, but it won't. The DUP are is this.
You can imagine how that'll go down in Ballymena.
Do you not think that Boris, and this is really more of a question for Sonia, when I saw the revelations unfolding over the last couple of days, it seems to me that Boris has this self-sabotaging piece that does kick in at certain points. Like, he has had the opportunity before to move closer to the Tory leadership. And there, you know, there is a certain type of person who is very happy, you know, being in the wings and undermining the person who essentially is the man in the arena, who's the one who's holding the power. Mm. It's actually much more difficult to then occupy that space yourself, leaving aside, as you say, the Nixon and China factor that Gerard talked about. And it seems to me that I've often wondered about Boris is that ultimately, despite all the bluster, despite all the emotional intelligence that he brings to appealing to his own cohort, whether he really believes himself he has what it takes. I thought there was a bit of self-sabotage going on the last couple of days.
Do you think, Sonia?
I think that's a really interesting point, actually. Yes. We saw after the result of the EU referendum in 2016 those shots of Boris Johnson looking like a rabbit in the headlights, he looked absolutely terrifying. I do think there is an argument here to say that for him it's all about the winning. It's becoming top dog. It's about the power rather than what you would do with the power. It's about the ambition, almost for ambition's sake. So he doesn't have, I mean, like Tony Blair loved power, but always had a plan. He wanted to modernise Labour Party, sure, but also the country. He had this sort of vision, really. You could say that he failed to achieve it, but he did have a vision of what he wanted to do. I think the really extraordinary thing for a politician that is Boris Johnson is what does he stand for apart from Boris Johnson? And I've known him, as I've said, since the 1990s. I still can't tell you that.
He stands for Boris, I guess, would be your opinion, would it? Funny, yeah, though, we had all these discussions around Trump as well. Oh, he doesn't really want to be the president, and when he does, it'll be... And Trump is now
running for
a second term, and all those crazy ideas he talked about, he is actually trying to follow through on all of them. Matthew Paris made another very interesting point in the Times yesterday as well. He said that he thinks Boris is starting to look uncomfortable because Boris has been forced to try and reinvent himself now as this kind of a calculator, a tightrope walker, a guy who's on detail, who's on top of it. And I thought you could see a bit of it yesterday. He's comfortable when he's cracking the funnies and entertaining the crowd, but there is that rabbit in the headlight thing you talked about when he actually needs to be serious. Jean?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, Boris Johnson's personal life is a matter of supreme indifference to me. But I think he was very optimistic in Birmingham last night when he said that people didn't want to hear about that sort of thing. I think people do want to hear.
I think
about
the crowd
that sort
there
of thing.
Possibly didn't.
And by the sounds of the laughing and jeering that went on, they didn't. But I think that story is going to run and run. I think it's absolutely going to affect his chances and not going to probably remove him from the likelihood of being the 25th Prime Minister. But it's definitely damaged him. I think one thing that is interesting is kind of how we see male politicians versus female politicians. Like, we always talk about the charisma of Boris. And, you know, if you were told you're going to a dinner party in a few weeks' time and he's going to be one of the guests, you think, great, I'll have a great night. You might also feel uneasy about some of the comments he has made about Muslim women, about Scottish people, about...
From Liverpool, apparently.
People from Liverpool.
Seen that?
I mean, I'm trying to think of what grouping hasn't had his ire, you know? And I think Britain has a lot of questions to answer, which it can only answer if he becomes Prime Minister, about how he represents them. I mean, there was one article, I know he was a journalist in a previous life, but you have to take it as journalistic writings because their opinion pieces were his opinions. And he made an extraordinary statement about Barack Obama a number of years ago and talked about the part Kenyan president's ancestral distrust of the British Empire. I mean, you don't have to be a psychologist or sociologist to see what he was getting at there. And I think it's troubling. Some of the things he said are troubling, but the things he does are even more troubling.
Sargine?
Well, look, I agree with what Niamh said about this element of self-sabotage. But that said, I have some sympathy for any politician who has their personal life raked over in such detail. I think one of the difficulties with that kind of thing is that it puts people off politics. And we need politicians, and we need good politicians and those who aren't afraid. That said, I've no doubt that this has weakened Boris. I think it will weaken him in Europe, and I think he's not going to be taken seriously. And I think it's more trouble for the UK and more trouble particularly for the people in England who have been very disturbed by what's happened since Brexit.
Sonia, two questions to finish up on. Yesterday, I have to admit, right, I was watching Boris and there's something kind of electrifying about it. And poor old James Hunt came on afterwards and he's a nice guy. But, you know, I've completely tuned out straight away. Has James, has Jeremy Hunt any hope at this stage?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's very hard to be up against Boris Johnson, and Jeremy Hunt does not have the personality that is in any way going to be able to compete on those grounds. I think it depends on really how people react to the stuff over about the row with the girlfriend. Because, you know, it's not just that. It's about national dignity. Do we want to have a prime minister who has a row so loud with his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend, whatever that their status is, you know, who's threatening, shouting at him to get off her or whatever? Do we want a prime minister who is known to have done that? And also, as the Sunday Times said in its front page this morning, this is a security risk. I mean, my late father used to work in government security, and I'm sure if he'd be around now, he'd be horrified. Because the thing is, if your private life is full of events, shall we put it, and perhaps events that we don't know, and there are all sorts of rumours swirling around, you are potentially compromise. It is difficult for a prime minister to have quite such a messy private life, whether or not we care about the morals of it.
Equally, if all of us were being recorded by our neighbours all the time, we'd certainly be in trouble. But one final question. The Sunday Times today also seems to have a suggestion that even if Boris makes it to prime minister, he could be ousted after one day, that there'd be a vote of no confidence and that MPs will resign, and that or that there will be pressure on Theresa May not to be able to say to the Queen that Boris Johnson can form a government. Do you think, is that wishful thinking, or do you think that could happen?
I think that Britain is in uncharted territory or uncharted waters, so I think anything could happen. And if people think that Boris Johnson is going to be able to calm things down and steer a steady course through what is a national crisis, a national breakdown, I mean, we're all absolutely pulling our hair out over here, I think they will be disappointed. I don't think it's likely, but I think it's possible that that could happen.
OK, Sonia Purnell, author of Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. Thank you very much, and we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel is still here. Gareth Sheehan, Jean Kelly, Niamh Horrigan, Dara Doyle and Gerard Howland. And I want to go back to the papers. It's funny how it's The Economy Stupid, but it's some weeks then it seems to get sidelined and nobody worries about it. But there are things hovering around in the sidelines there, Dara, that we should probably be thinking about, aren't there? You were looking at the Sunday Business Post, ESRI warns against further health overspend. The health spending situation is tipping away there in the background, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, famously, health spending is almost impossible to control. But like, to take a step back, the economy is in a pretty decent situation. I mean, I think we're growing sort of 4% this year, 3% next year. These are pretty good figures. And I suppose the fact that we're not talking about it too much anymore is a reflection that we're kind of taking it for granted in a way. Doesn't seem like a huge amount to worry about. The big unknown, I think, is what's going to happen around Brexit, obviously. So the ESRI was cautioning. It was suggesting that we're in slight danger of overheating, so maybe we should look at some tax increases. I mean, there's absolutely no way government is going to look at tax increases in, you know, 18 months before an election, so that's not going to happen. The other big concern is, of course, as I said, around Brexit, with the ESRI saying, well, let's leave ourselves a bit of room in case things go terribly wrong. Now, this kind of ties back into our discussion around Boris and around Ireland's position around the no-deal scenario, that kind of thing. So right now, there's absolutely no pressure on our government to move on the backstop. There's no external pressure. There's very little internal pressure to move on the backstop.
And the EU27 are standing by us.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm talking to capitals, you know, every day, every week, and you're always looking for a chink of light, you know, or sorry, wrong phrase, but a chink. apart from that, at one point, the Polish foreign minister suggested a 5-year timing on the backstop. He was quickly slapped down, and the solidarity is unanimous. There is an interesting sort of side note that I'm hearing. Apparently, a lot of countries are now being quite persistent in asking the Irish government, what's your plan for the border in a no-deal scenario? So you could see that as a benign question, but some people I'm talking to are saying, is there a subtext? Lads, get ready, because it's your choice. There's going to be a no deal. To an extent, it's your choice, so are you ready for it? Sorry, and the other point I want to make then is right now the whole no deal scenario is very theoretical. There's no internal pressure on the government to move. What will happen in a no deal scenario is that sterling will fall probably 10-15%. Okay, the multinationals, they don't care, they don't sell a lot to the UK. Who will really get squeezed will be the Irish firms, the SMEs, the farmers' tariffs. So will we begin to see some internal pressure on the government to kind of move? Now, sensing absolutely there's no sense at the moment. The government has done a remarkable job in lining people up behind them. But as we get closer to that no deal scenario, will that change? That's one thing to kind of look out for at the moment.
Eve.
One of the most interesting pieces is actually Dan O'Brien's, and it's following on really from the comments, the Fiscal Advisory Council comments this week, which are again really along the same lines as the SRI, basically saying, look, we're in danger of overheating, let's not go crazy with the spending. I suppose one of the issues that's concerned to IFAC is, I suppose, a lack of lessons learned in the sense that we're spending on the basis of corporation tax receipts, which are not necessarily repeat income, and then we're increasing, you know, our spending in terms of, you know, hiring people, etc.
And now we should say that the government, Pascal Donoghue and Leo Varadkar, are being quite clear on this, that we are factoring in less corporation tax in the next few years into our calculations, and that they are, you know, running a deficit, putting money into the running away money, as you could call it. And, you know, they're being very prudent.
But I think, to be fair to IFAC, they're not entirely buying it, let's put it that way. And I think there's two things going on. What Dan O'Brien is picking up is the sense that there's relatively little public appetite to, for instance, for tax increases, say, for instance, or significant spending cuts. And I think that's what, you know, in fairness to Taoiseach and Pascal Donoghue are identifying. But there are, I suppose, bigger questions in the long term. And I suppose the issue is the cliff edge of the no-deal Brexit, do you know what I mean? And from the point of view, I think, in fairness of people in the public sector, they're saying, well, you know, if I'm thinking about hiring somebody in the morning and the country could be in recession by Christmas, there'll be an employment control framework, there'll be no hiring, and therefore, so I do think there's a kind of a living memory here in Ireland. Like, say, for somebody like me in my mid-40s, I've lived through two deep recessions in my lifetime, and those recessions were so deep that no rainy day fund kind of could dig us out of them. And I suppose, I think people then feel, well, then if that's what's going to be on the horizon, we just have to deal with now and make now as good as we can and try and patch as many holes as we can in the short term. So I think Brexit, and I think this is linked in, Brendan, to the lack of tolerance, which Simon Coveney talked about this week, of people for more Brexit extensions. It's creating such uncertainty in the long term for planning, not just around the economy, but all kinds of policy areas, that's becoming really tiring as much as anything else.
Yeah, and for businesses as well.
People about the business this week, and there's a sense of the previous extension, the boy who cried wolf. Current people I'm speaking to, businesses are no longer making preparations for a cliff edge because we've been, what was the phrase somebody used to me? We marched the troops up the hill at least twice now for a possible extension. It didn't happen. People took huge costs preparing for a no deal Brexit. Now they just don't believe it's going to happen.
So it's gone into millennium bug territory.
Been here before. You told us the march is going to crash. It didn't happen. So there's two different sides to this. The government is genuinely worried on one hand that we're getting towards. Like, what I hear is that there may well be one more extension, but that will be the last one. On the other side,
the line on another extension is that it's either for a general election there or for a second referendum.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suspect that when we come to the apocalypse, when we come to the cliff edge at the end, mid, late October, and there's no deal, I suspect that people will pull back from that. I mean, there's a real tendency. I remember actually talking to Michael Noonan about this around Greece and the euro. And, you know, ultimately, the EU didn't want Greece to exit the euro. Greece ultimately didn't want to leave the euro. So a way was found to avoid that. And so that's been a scenario all around that. You generally, if two sides want to avoid apocalypse, you will find a way to do it.
So someone will blink is what you're saying.
No, not necessarily. You'll kick the can again down the road, top and agree. So one more extension, the next one might be the real one. But on the other hand, business doesn't believe it at all. They're saying, look, this is going to be avoided. So we've been hit before.
Businesses are saying it's never going to happen.
Well, not every business, but sure, to be sure. But a lot of businesses who took costs at the end of March apocalypse was avoided are saying we're not doing that again.
Okay, Gareth Sheehan.
Well, I don't. I mean, I just find the thing very, very difficult. I hear what Dara and Eve were saying. I don't think that I've an awful lot to add to it. What it has done and what is this is that we have been so focused on this matter for 3 years now, or almost 3 years, that a whole lot of other matters are not being discussed. And that's also happened, I think, obviously in the UK, because that's not really our concern, but it's prevented us from getting on and having a serious discussion about so many other matters
And you see, this
we've been done damage by
Boris as well, doesn't it? Because there is this "just do it" attitude out there among people. Just get it over with. We're sick of it. And there are people who don't support the Tories, who don't support Boris, who are saying, "Listen, if this guy can just move us on, fine, let's have it." Gerard Howland.
I was talking to somebody in London who talking to some business people there, and basically the familiarity of talk about Brexit and hard Brexit over such a long period has anaesthetised the fear of it. And I think there's a bit of that here too. A no-deal Brexit will be a horrific event. It will be deeply dislocating economically immediately. As somebody put it cruelly, but unfortunately very truthfully, you cannot retrain a 50-year-old mushroom farmer in Monaghan to be a hedge fund manager in the IFSC. And there's a lot of industries in rural Ireland, particularly food industries, who are selling into the UK supermarkets on very thin margins, and for whom time, by the way, in moving these fresh goods from A to B is incredibly important. And the drop in sterling alone, not to talk of tariffs, will literally put them out of business. And those are, unlike in Dublin, where, you know, a lot of people will have other choices for a while, in those rural areas, there won't be other choices.
Okay.
So it's a huge community effect.
Yeah. The question you're potentially, do you see at some point public opinion, if we're on a no-deal scenario trajectory, public opinion turning against the backstop? Or do you think people will say they're having to go over the...
What happens to a government in power when something awful is happening is they're blamed for it, because they're there concurrently with it. And I don't think it would be fair to blame the government. I'm not sure there was any other option open to it. But if the consequences come on their watch, they will suffer for it.
OK, on that note, we'll take a break.